Good morning, we're the Historians. I'm Jay Sammons, here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brendan McConville.
Coming to you from the shadow of Bellevue Hill and the mystical banks of the Electronic Charles.
Wonderful. It's a fine spring morning, Professor McConville. I'm going to have a, what are you having for breakfast? What's your spring breakfast going to be today?
I'm having a garlic bagel. My carb resolve has collapsed.
Oh, really?
Not collapsed, but I do, you know, I do put some fat on there by putting butter on, much butter. I'm going to have 3 strips of bacon and some orange juice.
Good. You know, I saw a friend of ours at breakfast recently. He will remain unnamed. We were fishing. And we went to breakfast.
Is this an older fishing friend or younger? Or, you know,
well, I don't really have any. I don't have any younger.
Contemporary.
Yes, an older one.
An older one.
And we were eating breakfast at a greasy spoon diner in a small town, and which I love. And he was scraping butter off of his toast because he felt that they had put too much butter on the toast. I found this appalling. This was. I don't understand.
I know who this is.
Yes.
I mean, I salute your anti-dairy virtue.
No.
I just eat it. You're
exactly.
Fine.
I mean, what, too much butter? I don't even understand those words. So I think I will have some rye toast. Since you're having carbs, I'm going to have carbs too. Right. I'm going to have rye toast with too much butter on it. Well done home fries. Yeah. And I'll have 2 eggs over easy with sausage links. To go with that, and a steaming cup of mediocre coffee.
Delicious. Delicious.
Did you ever notice that diner coffee is a thing? You don't drink coffee, so you wouldn't even know this, really.
No, but I do know that. There's a huge difference between diner coffee, Dunkin' Donuts coffee, and Starbucks coffee.
Right. Well, you know,
three different genres.
We've discussed my theory about this, I think, at some point. I don't know if we've done it on air before, that one of the ways I see modern culture collapsing, one of the many ways, is that everything is turned into one of two things, either a commodity or a fetish.
Yeah.
And coffee is a perfect example. You have commodity coffee that you get in a diner, and you have fetish coffee that you get at Starbucks, et cetera. Dunkin' Donuts has tried to split the difference, but you see that they are trending now towards fetishizing coffee because you can get macchiatos and cappuccinos and lattes and all that stuff there.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating. You've missed your calling as a sociological evaluator.
I agree with you. I have. So. So we're going to wrap up our section on early Greece today and we're going to get to the point where the Greeks come out of the Dark Age, and we're going to set up what we might think of as the Greek miracle for the explosion of Greek culture across the Aegean and the Mediterranean, in fact, which we'll pick up on the other side of our summer hiatus at some point. Because we're going to take our traditional summer hiatus. You always have a nice little speech you make about what historians do. Well, shall we save that for the end of the
Let's save that for the end of the show, yes.
All right. But we're going to get out of the Dark Age and look at the Greek world in the years around, say, 800 to 700 BC, when maybe 650. When the Dark Age was finally over. Were you depressed by the Greek Dark Age? Did you come through it okay yourself?
I found it a little dark, but, you know, there was a lot. Look, you don't know really what was happening other than that a few people tried to preserve writing, and there was, I'm sure, quite a bit of killing, raiding, burning, and doing looting and doing other bad things, you know?
Yep.
I mean, sort of not, it was not nice.
It is funny to think about those Greeks on the island of Cyprus who managed to preserve writing even as they were cut off from the rest of the Greek world. And of course, their writing system eventually came to nothing. I mean, it was a kind of dead end in terms of writing.
But other people must have seen them writing, and then that led to a revival of writing or a use of writing otherwhere, you know, in other places. I think it was because they were isolated on Cyprus and the location of Cyprus, right? That made it because there were people to write to in Egypt, right? There were people to write to somewhere in the Near East.
We don't know that they had any kind of communication by means of writing with those places, and they weren't using a system that the Egyptians or the Phoenicians would have understood. So they were using it locally, but it seems as if they were more or less cut off. I mean, that's one of the factors in this Dark Age world, is that that kind of communication between these other places is just not going on.
But in this period, the Phoenician alphabet had grown, and in other words, Phoenician writing had become...
Right. Phoenicians were writing and using that alphabet that the Greeks would adopt, and we talked about that in the last episode, this amazing technological advancement. But the form of writing that they were using on Cyprus just came to a dead end, which was a kind of combination of Linear A and Linear B, the Mycenaean and Minoan scripts. And it just disappears.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Now, it may have been killed off in competition with the Phoenician alphabet, right? That would kind of make sense, because the Phoenician alphabet is so much more, and the way the Greeks adapted it with vowels and consonants made it much more useful. So it's highly likely that Cypriot script just died because it was, you know, it couldn't compete. But the world that emerges in when we start to see things, and things begin to clarify around 750 BC or so, is so different from the world, the Mycenaean world that we talked about, you know, with these palaces and the Trojan War, and you know, and yet there are points of continuity. But one thing that continues is that when the Greeks emerge with writing again in around 750, they're worshiping the same gods. Okay. It's Zeus and Athena and Aphrodite and the same gods that we see mentioned in those Linear B scripts from 1300, 1250 BC. It's the same. There aren't as many female gods. The Zeus S has disappeared.
Why?
We don't know. The Poseidon S, the female version of Poseidon, seems to has disappeared.
There must be some wild scholarly speculation on the meaning of that, right?
There is, and I'm not an anthropologist who's equipped to talk much about it. There are these competing theories about the origins of mother goddesses in the Greek world and the representations of female deities and what those representations were used for. But it's a fact, nonetheless, that there seems to be a slightly more male-centered religion when it emerges after the Dark Age. Now, the values that the Greeks are going to express for the rest of their history are also clearly there in this early period. You know, excellence, arete, or arete, the way classicists pronounce it. Arete is a word that means, it's often translated as virtue, but it really means, excellence in the sense that, you know, whatever your task is, whatever a knife, what is a knife supposed to do? A knife is supposed to cut. So the arete of a knife, the excellence of a knife, is that it cuts well, right? A wheel is supposed to roll. The arete of a wheel is that it rolls well. You know, so what is the excellence of a human being? And this is a question that will dominate Greek thought for the rest of, until today. You know, what makes a human being excellent? And as soon as the Greeks emerge, as soon as Homer begins to be written down, the Homeric poems, 750 BC or so, we think they started to write down Homeric poetry. Arete is defined as two things. One, the ability to speak well, and the ability to fight. It's being a warrior and being a good spokesman, counselor, a wise advocate. It's amazing that speech plays this role in Greek culture from the very beginning that we can see it, but it does. Sometimes the culture that seems to be dominant in Greece is described as shame culture, which means, you know, you avoid disgrace and you avoid shame and you seek glory. Okay. Timi is the word in Greek, timi, which means, it means honor, but it means honor in its philosophical sense, but also honor in its concrete sense, like the stuff you get when you conquer another city. You know, the woman that
what's given to you as your role for your role in these.
That's right, and what you take
backings, and what you take, right?
Yeah, and you demonstrate your excellence, your arete, by gaining timi, this honor. Okay, so the two things are related to each other. If you think about it, those ideas are not about inheritance. They're about demonstrated merit in the moment. And I think that that really those ideas are more related to the Dark Age in Greece than they are to the earlier period. You know, those palaces from the period 1400 to 1200, whatever, those palaces were apparently ruled by kings. And those kings almost certainly passed their power on to their children, where their sons, where they were able to. But this idea of arete and timi is really about demonstrating excellence in the moment now. And I think this is one of the reasons that the Homeric heroes don't have long lineages. You know, we talked about this in an episode long ago when we talked about Homer. The Homeric heroes can't name their great-great-great-great-grandfathers who did X, Y, or Z. Sometimes they can say, my father did X. And in very rare occasions, grandfather. But usually the line goes no further back than the father. And oftentimes it doesn't go back at all. Like, these are self-made heroes. Okay, who are demonstrating. And that to me bespeaks the world like this world of raiding that we looked at, you know, in the previous episodes. You know, these are guys going out.
A heroic standard. You're measured by this, your standard in action.
Right. Can you give victory in battle and convince other men to follow you? And those are the things you have to be able to do.
Well, given the nature of the world they were living in, it would seem to me that why that's important is pretty clear.
Yeah, exactly so. And that idea is going to continue throughout Greek culture, the need to demonstrate your merit in the present. But what's going to develop, of course, is also this idea of inherited excellence, right? So these are really competing ideas that are going to continue to float around in the Greek
world. Don't you think that idea of inherited excellence comes with a more stable territoriality? In other words, your agricultural, you know, it becomes an agricultural district, it becomes a town, and you need to defend that area, and that is very closely tied to the idea of hereditary authority.
Well, think about it too. Land is that thing which you can pass down. Right. So the land may be at the very core of it. I hate to sound like a Marxist, but it's the truth.
Go ahead. Jump off the deep end.
Yeah, really. There's no doubt there's a material factor here. But when we start to look at so that's really a Homeric view of the world. But when we look at the poetry of Hesiod, which is being written down about the same time, and now we're talking about, you know, 700, 650 BC or so, you know, Hesiod wrote two poems that we have, the Works and Days and the Theogony. The Theogony is about the origins of the gods and their relationships to one another, et cetera. The Works and Days is a more interesting poem, I think, for these purposes, because what Hesiod shows is that although the Greeks are worshiping the same gods, they're beginning to think of them somewhat differently. In the Iliad, the Greek gods are not interested in anything like justice. Right, Zeus is not a god of justice in the Iliad. He's just a god who favors one side over the other, and the other gods are the same. They choose a side and they fight for that side. There's no interest. There's no moral question and no question of justice. But in Hesiod, which in the Works and Days, which is a poem really about farming and how to run your estate,
Hesiod, I read at Reed College in 1980.
That's great. Before you had an estate,
right? Before I had an estate, right.
But in Hesiod, we see a new idea, and that is that Zeus has a daughter, and that daughter is Dike, or Dike, justice. And justice is somehow associated with the god Zeus. And Hesiod says, Zeus is watching, and I think he will punish you if you act in unjust ways. He's not sure about it. He hopes that Zeus is going to do this. But we see that the idea of the gods playing some kind of role as an arbiter of justice, as arbiters of justice, is emerging. And that's a new thing on the Greek horizon.
Again, that speaks to territoriality, because you must maintain justice within in the community, in the group. Yep. We're coming up on our first break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
This is Mike Jannetty. Join me every Wednesday afternoon from 12 noon to 2 p.m. for DJ Mike Jannetty's Disco Dance Party on WNTN.
Hi, this is Mike D'Estacio, host of Real Talk with the Hollywood Kid. Join me every Saturday from 2 to 3 when I'll be interviewing some of the biggest stars in showbiz right here on the legendary airwaves of AM 1550 And you can also stream us worldwide at WNTN1550AM.com. You can climb a mountain.
You can swim the sea. All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking about Greece emerging from the Dark Age. It's about 750, 700 BC. You just mentioned, Brendan, that this concern for justice must at least partly reflect the fact that we're living in a settled fashion now. Hesiod is talking about farming, so that's speaking to the same. You know, we're not talking about raiding. We're not running off and raiding some other state. We're actually settled down. Hesiod talks about what kind of ox you need to have, what kind of servants you need to have. You know, how do you ship your goods somewhere else? You know, how do you take care of them? This is a settled life we're looking at, and yeah, the concern for justice is absolutely central to that poem.
It bespeaks landed property and the efforts to control landed property and bounded property in an agricultural community. I mean,
yep. Sometimes people really try to treat Hesiod as a kind of peasant, you know, as if he's the voice, but he's not. I mean, he has a boat. He's interested in profiting. He's not a subsistence farmer. You know, he's arguing with his brother. The whole poem is written to his brother, and he says, "Brother, you're worthless. You stole from me. Blah blah blah. You know, you took part of my inheritance, etc." I mean, there's things to fight over here, and it's basically about land. So we're seeing a cultural difference here now that is evincing a new kind of lifestyle. And there's some other cultural differences that maybe we can talk about in this segment, things that are emerging in this period and things that people associate with Greekness. Okay. So when you talk to people about Greekness, one of the things they'll often bring up to you is good music, is the Olympic Games. Right, Olympic Games. This is like when, what happened? They brought the Olympic Games back in 1896, and they took them. They had the Olympic Games in Athens, and we got the Olympics restarted. But of course, they go back. The Greeks believe to 776 BC. That's the traditional starting date for the Olympic Games. And I'm sure our listeners know what the Olympic Games were, but you know, just in case they don't, every 4 years in the middle of the summer, they would declare a truce. So there's not supposed to be any fighting now during the Olympic Games truce. Of course, there was sometimes. And people, city-states, would send their athletes to Olympia, which is in western Peloponnese in southern Greece. And they would compete there in, running, chariot races, wrestling, boxing, you know, javelin throwing. The kind of things you associate with the Olympic
Games, right?
Right, exactly. Hockey, of course, hockey was big. No, kidding. this led to some interesting moments. Like I think we mentioned before, a Macedonian king showed up and wanted to compete, and the Greeks had to decide, well, do we think these Macedonians are Greeks or not?
And they ultimately let them compete.
Yes, they
recall.
Did. They decided, yes, you are Greek. You're weird Greek, but yes, you are Greek.
Right.
You're king. We won't really get that apart from the Spartans. But, you know, the Olympic Games led to some really interesting moments in Greek history. For example, the Spartans once were accused of having violated the Olympic truce because the truce had been declared at some other city, but it hadn't been declared at Sparta yet. So because they sent, you know, messengers around to declare, OK, it's time for the Olympic truce. Well, it hadn't been declared at Sparta yet. And the Spartans went and attacked another city. Well, the people who ran the Olympic Games then disbarred the Spartans from participating in the Olympic Games because they said, you violated the Olympic truce. And the Spartans said, no, we didn't. It hadn't been declared at Sparta when we attacked the other city. And they said, well, it doesn't matter whether it had been declared at Sparta or not. It had been declared elsewhere. And the Spartans' response to that was, then why did you send a herald to declare it at Sparta? Which they did, which is a brilliant kind of argument here.
When did, just to fulfill my curiosity, when did Sparta become historically visible, and when did it take on the reputation of being Sparta?
Yeah. Well, the answer to that is it's historically visible from the moment we know of Greece, that even in the Mycenaean period, you can see from Homer's poetry that Sparta is already immensely important. Okay, it's a secondary city to Mycenae, and Argos. It's not as important. Menelaus is the king of Sparta, the brother of Agamemnon, the king of Mycenae. Right. So Mycenae is already an important place in the Bronze Age. And as soon as we can see the Greek world operating again, Sparta is important. There's not a time that we can see where the Spartans are playing or like a third tier power or a second tier power or whatever.
And were they at that time dominant over the Helots, training militarily in the way that we consider them, you know, to have done in the classical period? Living in that, is that how we see them?
Okay, so you're pushing us forward into an episode we'll have to come back to in the fall on archaic Sparta, but I'll just spoil it a little bit and say, we know a fair amount about the period where Sparta helotized the other Greeks in Messenia, which is the western part of southern Peloponnese. And that was from about 730 or 40 BC to about 630 or 40 BC. So it's just in this period when Sparta seems to start militarily dominating the southern part. So that's beginning now. They had apparently already helotized, turned into serfs, the other Greeks in the area around Sparta. Okay. But they crossed a big mountain range and they start to do that in southwestern Peloponnese. So that the fact that they could do that tells us that Sparta is already a powerful state.
Right. And just for our listeners, the Helot is not a slave. It's like a feudal serf.
Exactly.
Attached to the land.
Attached to the land. Really, if you want to think of ownership, owned by the state, but really, you know, a serf is a better way to think of the Helots. Yeah. So Sparta doesn't have a period of not being known or powerful or important in the early Greek world, whereas Athens very much does. So, you know, Greeks from all over the Greek world could participate in these Olympic Games, but really it was the southern Greeks and the Greeks from the west, like Sicily, Sicilian Greeks, Greeks who had colonized Sicily that also seemed to have participated more than the very most northern Greeks. And these Olympic Games were so popular that they spun off other games. You know, eventually there'll be games at the Isthmus, the Isthmian Games around Corinth, Nemea. Nemean games. There were games at Delphi. And so, you know, there's a proliferation of these games, but the Olympic games are the ones that are always the most important and the most prestigious. Another cultural thing that united the Greeks in this period was Delphi itself, right? There were lots of oracles in the Greek world, places where you could go and consult a priest or priestess who might be able to tell you something about what the gods think about X or Y. You know, like a government agency, but Delphi was far and away the most important of the Greek oracles. And we don't really know how it was established, but from a very early period, from this period, from the 8th century, it seems Greeks were already going there and trying to consult Apollo. Apollo was associated with this mountaintop shrine in Delphi. It's an amazing place. It's someplace I really encourage people to go because you have to go up this windy, windy road to get up there. And when you get up there, it's a spooky place. I mean, you can see why the Greeks thought, this is the kind of place that the gods would hang out, you know, where Apollo would come down. So you would go up there, make an incredibly difficult trip to get up to this place. And then you have to go through this purification ritual. You have to pay a fee. And then you go in and ask your question of the god. And there would be a priestess there, the Pythia, Pythian Apollo. Pytho is a place. Pythian Apollo and would speak to you through the priestess, and the priestess would mumble something that nobody could understand. But the priests would then take down what she said, but it would always be in poetry. So you would get handed to you your official response of Apollo, you know, in the form of a nice little bit of poetry.
This sounds like a machine that used to be on the boardwalk in Seaside Heights when I was a teenager.
Put a nickel in, and
your everything comes popping out. Yes. Yeah,
is this a Tom Hanks movie? Is this the movie Big? Isn't this?
Yeah, right.
And he married a Greek American, so there's the connection. No. Yeah, and so states could send ambassadors to request to make a question of Apollo. The Spartans actually had the closest connections with Delphi and the Spartans had official state ministers that they sent up there to ask questions of Delphi. Or you could go as you know, just as an individual, like Socrates' buddy, who went up there and asked, "Is any man wiser than Socrates?" And got the answer, "No man is wiser than Socrates." Of course, this is one of the famous oracles. But if you think about it, one of the things that happened at Delphi is that states would send, city-states would send ambassadors up there to ask about colonies, founding colonies. Should we send a colony to Egypt? You know, would the Black Sea be a good place to found a colony?
This, of course, is something we had talked about off the air before the episode, after the last episode, about the explosion of Greek colonies in the Eastern and then Central and finally Western Mediterranean and then into the Black Sea region.
Yep.
Did they try to establish colonies in North Africa and in Egypt as well?
Yes. Yes. At least one in, there was one on the Nile and one on the Western, in what's Cyrene, ancient right. Cyrene, Cyrenaica. So not so many in North Africa, but they did.
This explosion of colonies suggests, again, settled agricultural life, higher caloric intake, population rise.
Right.
You're going to calf people off.
Yeah, and you're right. And sometimes the oracle at Delphi would tell a state to found a colony. They didn't get asked a question. You know, the city-state would send an ambassador up there about something else, and the response they would get was X, and also you should found a colony. And you're right. There has to be excess population to do this, right? Because where else are the people? If you're worried about defending your own city state, you're not going to send out a bunch of your guys, you know, your army, and tell them to go somewhere else and found another place. You got to have excess population.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I do think that I just want to clarify for our listeners, their idea of what a colony was isn't like, say, 19th century imperialism. It's a very different notion of colony, which is that the colonies were sent out as autonomous communities, but with a close cultural tie to their mother city. Is that a fair characterization?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. They treated the city that sent out the colony was called the mother city, the metropolis. Okay, that's what mother city. And they maintained a cultural relationship with the mother city, sometimes really close, sometimes fairly hostile. Corinth had some colonies that didn't see eye to eye. Corcyra and Corinth didn't get along, the daughter city. But yeah, they adopted the same religious structure, the same political structure, the same tribal structure. They essentially made a kind of mirror image where they
same
could.
Gods, same you know, gods, favor, exactly. Same gods, exactly. Favor the same gods. And
yep. Yeah, exactly. And they sent those, and these, now a lot of the stories we have about the founding of colonies sound like it was a fairly peaceful process. But I suggest that that's, as we have said, one of the laws of the historians is when you have to choose between war and not war as an explanation, or violence and not.
Yeah, right. Yeah, choose war. It's violence and not violence. Choose violence.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, if you think about it, how do you choose who's going to get sent out on this colony? You know, it's not as if you could go on Google and search the place you were going and find out where the coffee shops were and get a nice Airbnb that you can stay when you get there. You know, it's not going to be like that. You're going to show up at a place where there are almost certainly going to be other people.
And you're going to have to fight.
And you're going to have to take their land. Okay. They're not just going to say, oh, you're Greeks. It's 750 BC. It's time for the colony. Okay. Let's move inland. Give it to everybody. Come on. The Greeks are here.
They're not always so pleasant about it, right?
Not going to. So there's probably was violence in the home city to determine who's going to have to leave and who's going to have to stay. And then there's definitely going to be violence when you get to wherever you're going to take over this land.
Right.
And this process went all over the Mediterranean. It started in the area closest to Greece, as you said, and then, you know, in northern Greece where they founded a lot of colonies, in the Black Sea where they founded a lot of colonies, in Italy, southern Italy, Sicily, southern France, Spain.
Sardinia.
Yeah, Sardinia. Right. So there are Greek colonies all over Mediterranean.
Did they establish colonies outside the pillars? Outside the
one, one at least, yes, outside the.
Where was that?
On I guess it would be Portugal today. The just outside. If I'm remembering this correctly, there's a Greek colony that's just outside the pillars to the north of the pillars of Heracles.
One thing I would share, which is you know just an aside on this, is that actually I'll save that aside for our after our second break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
There's an old New England saying for just about everything in life, but our favorite is this one. Use only the finest 100% Arabica beans. We're the New England Coffee Company, and we've been perfecting the art of coffee roasting for over 85 years. All that experience has created a reputation for exceptional coffee, so that every cup is rich, satisfying, delicious, in the New England tradition. New England Coffee, available at your local supermarket.
This is Mike Janity. Join me every Thursday afternoon between 12 noon and 2 o'clock for our Cape Cod Happy Hour Party, featuring all of your favorite party and sing-along songs from the 60s, 70s, and 80s right here on WNTN 1550 AM and WNTN.com.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking about Greek colonization, coming out of the Dark Age. But before we get back to that story, we have to welcome back our historical sponsor, the Island of Elba, a retirement community. Now, Brendan, you know, neither of us are as young as we used to be.
Speak for yourself. Right. Speak for yourself. I retain my youthful vitality.
That's true. You do. That's true. But have you given any thought to retirement, nevertheless?
Over the last couple of weeks, I have.
Yeah, so have I. Well, this week it's great that we have, because we're really happy to have back this historical sponsor, which just may help us make these difficult choices about where to spend our golden years. I mean, the Island of Elba, a community for active seniors, founded in 1814 at the request, not to say insistence, of at least three European great powers. The Island of Elba retirement community began as a very special home for a single, hardly aging retiree. Do you know who that might have been, Professor McConville?
I believe he was a Corsican.
He was L'Empereur Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, the restless emperor only spent 300 days on the island, but he was later to recall that they were, quote, the most perfect 300 days of my brilliant, if abortive, career. Napoleon found the Mediterranean climate superb, très magnifique, and the varied topography gave him ample opportunity for exploration, if not conquest. Bonaparte was particularly fond of the apiaries that cover the island, and the longtime fan of beekeeping is supposed to have said, quote, Elba produces the sweetest honey east of Corsica. True, the first great retiree on Elba eventually and somewhat hurriedly left the island, which he found lacked opportunities for displaying his political and military acumen. But once he had retired again to the island of St. Helena, he frequently remarked, quote, only a moron would leave Elba. Quel dommage. Now, for more information on the Island of Elba, which I'm happy to say now boasts a McDonald's that opens at 5 a.m. every day, where you and I will be, Brendan, very soon, as the senior men that we are, early there, right, reading the Financial Times.
Right. And discussing Star Trek. That shows you how we've grown, right?
Yeah, that's right. So for more information, visit nobourbons.com, like the Bourbon Monarchs, nobourbons.com, or email the community at fwellington@gmail.com. Again, the email address is fwellington@gmail.com.
The Island of Elba. You'll be imprisoned here forever.
fwellington@gmail.com. I love that address. I really do. All right. So where were we? We were founding colonies all over the Mediterranean, talking about the fact that it was probably somewhat, there was violence involved, let's be clear, and that it might not have been such a happy occasion for those who saw a Greek ship pulling into their harbor around 700 BC.
I think that's a fair assumption, yes, I do. They weren't coming for the weekend.
Yeah, and if it was and if it was 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 ships, it's really a problem. And I you know, it's funny, the Greek history textbooks treat this event like it was just a kind of a big vacation party. You know, the Greeks were floating around the Mediterranean and founding happy little colonies. But I don't think they were all so happy for the people who were already there.
As I said during the break, I think that when you look at it, you can see, you know, obviously they're invading these places. People are unhappy. They're probably fighting off other Greeks too, who show up in the same area, who decide they want to colonize that area. I'm sure that happened. I had asked, and we had talked a little bit about, you know, did they move into the central and western Mediterranean with some knowledge of what the Phoenicians had found there?
Yeah. Well, you know, the traditional date of the founding of Carthage in North Africa by the Phoenicians is 814 BC, which is interesting because it predates the earliest Greek colonies by about 50 or 60 years, which seemed to date from about 750. And the Greeks themselves apparently believed this. So it's interesting that they apparently thought the Phoenicians had been colonizing for longer than they had. And they certainly avoided the areas where the Phoenicians were already powerful: Western North Africa, Western Sicily, parts of Spain. Those places are going to be dominated by the Phoenicians, whereas the Greeks are going to colonize, for example, Eastern Sicily. And Sicily is going to be the real prize that the Greeks and the Phoenicians are going to fight over for the
because
next
it's so months. Fertile, right? Because it's so fertile.
And it's a nice place. It's centrally located. You know, it's location, location, location.
Yeah, but if you read about the topography of Sicily, because of all the volcanic activity, the soil is really rich, and I think you get a strong set of harvests there. But one question I did want to ask you is this, is that, so they knew, and we had discussed whether they had established a colony outside the gates, outside the pillars, and you had said, yeah, there were at least one, and the Phoenicians, of course, had gone outside the pillars. But right. I was reading an account a number of years ago, but not too many years ago, about 7 years ago, of the Canary Islands. And when the Romans exiled, the people of the Canary Islands are related to the people of North or Northwest Africa who the Romans exiled on the Canary Islands after a rebellion of some kind. And when the Romans went out there, they saw ruins, which they described as temples, you know, to someone's gods, you know, that in other words, there had been some kind of settlement, you know, significant settlement there, which I assume had to be either Greek or Phoenician. Have you ever read anything about that?
You're telling me a story that I've never heard before. Amazingly enough, I don't know this story.
There were ruins out there of some kind.
That's amazing. I would love to know the source of this. It sounds like the kind of thing Pliny the Elder would have written about. If I had to guess, I'm going to guess the source of that is Pliny the Elder. Who wrote things about, you know, elephants that could scratch their own names into the dirt, and you know, it was kind of stuff he was interested in. But I'll have to circle back to you on that one, Professor.
How far east was the farthest east colony in the easternmost portion of the Black Sea region?
Easternmost portion of the Black Sea.
I see.
Yep. So they covered the whole Mediterranean, basically, right, and the Black Sea. Now, this takes us back to the subject I wanted to wrap up my part of the show today on the political and social organization of these colonies. They apparently were founded as city-states, as polis, okay? And usually Greek historians teach that the polis developed in this period, you know, the 8th century BC, the Greeks come out of the Dark Age and they begin developing this system, the polis. And I don't find that credible at all. For one reason, because they're already founding colonies in this form, you know, around 750. That tells me the form pre-exists. And I suggested in the previous episode that the polis structure, which is about, socially, it's about organization into tribes, and tribes are used to worship, and they're also used to fight. And it's also about the leadership structure of these people. We're going to elect leaders. You know, there'll be families that have a certain amount of power, aristocratic families, but the idea of an assembly of warriors, okay, and the organization of people into tribes, these ideas, I think, are ideas that predate this period by a significant time. And I suggested in the previous episode that they are a way of organizing a people in motion. How do we move to a new spot? So we had Greeks moving in the years in the Dark Age, you know, 1100, 1900 BC, Greeks are moving to the islands, they're moving to Asia Minor, you know. And I think when they started moving into these colonies, they organized themselves in the same way. And the polis is a artifact of these Greek movements, and not some new settlement form that was developed in, you know, 750 BC or so. That's just my hypothesis, though. All right. Of course, the city-state itself, the polis form of government is going to be, and the polis is more than a form of government. It's a way to organize ourselves for our family life, our religious life. It's going to be, you know, one of the most remarkable developments in the Greek world, because self-government was just not something that was practiced in the ancient Mediterranean. No, you know, you look around and you're not going to find too many assemblies which are voting on doing X or Y. You know, are we going to fight this war? Or are we going to send out this colony? But already in Homer, you know, you can see that the voice of the people is playing a role in those debates between those kings in early in the Iliad. You know, the men are being called to assembly and they're listening to speakers and they're crying out in favor of one view or another. You have a kind of nascent polis there. And Homer's poetry is clearly being influenced by, you know, what he saw around him. But the exactly how the polis originated is a question we can't answer. And it may have been influenced from other cultures, but we can't trace them. You know, there's some idea that the Phoenician city-states bore some similarities. They have a senate, for example, an assembly of older advisors.
But the idea of polis does suggest a broad distribution of landed property. In other words, that's one of the things it definitely suggests. And it suggests the interdependence that comes with that. In other words, which comes to be known in the Western tradition as classical humanist civic notion of civic virtue. In other words, we've all got to stand together and fight for the common good if we're threatened, because there's no way to keep our system and our culture together if we do not.
And I think bringing fighting into it, Brendan, the military aspect of it is really important, because, you know, once you're fighting in mass infantry groups, numbers play a very important role in whether you can win or not. It's not always the decisive role, but it's a very important role. How you're armed, how you're organized, you know, even tactics and strategy play a role, but numbers perhaps play the greatest role. So you need the largest infantry possible. And to be an infantryman in the Greek world at this time, you had to have some money. Of course, there wasn't money. You had to have wealth. You had to be able to afford a shield, a spear, a helmet, a breastplate, right? These are not inexpensive items. And the state is not going to provide them for you. You're going to have to provide them for yourself. So you need substantial middle class, essentially the emergence of a middle class that can afford these things. And they're
farmers. And of course, thus the willingness and the ability to bear arms becomes central to your identity, social, political, cultural identity, because it's clear in these polices that only people who bear arms and are involved in this stuff are making any decisions at all.
Absolutely true.
Despite whatever claims scholars may make, as you know, I've read a lot of Greek history, but nothing in Greek itself. I don't read ancient Greek, so just in English. But you can see that some people make claims otherwise, but it's clear from the nature of those towns that that is not viable. You have to be an armed citizen.
And the Greeks were very, very slow to give up that idea. And in Athens, where they did enfranchise people who didn't have property earlier than probably any other Greek city-state, they still did it at a time where those propertyless Athenians were rowing in the fleet, right? They were still serving, you know, so there was a way you could justify this
service to the state.
Yeah. So I think that's crucial. Now, you know, Victor Davis Hanson wrote an absolutely great book on this subject called The Other Greeks.
Yeah, superb piece of scholarship.
It's one of the few books that in the last 30 years, I think, in Greek history that really is an epochal work. And because what he argued was that not only did these farmers revolutionize, you know, the fighting but they created an ideology, just what you were describing. And this idea of the middle and the mean, right, playing an important role, that's an idea that emerges with this system of organizing ourselves for fighting and for worship. And it hadn't existed anywhere in the Near Eastern world. That's the point. You know, there weren't independent farmers running their own show in the Near East, in Mesopotamia, in Egypt. Those were things where land was controlled from the top.
Right. Okay. Empires. They're empires. Empires
and kingdoms not controlled by individual freeholders.
Right. Those two world-changing factors, the independent freeholder and the polis structure, emerge in the period and go on to define many norms of what comes to be called Western culture. We are up on our final break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Hi, this is Debbie Dedarian Demetriadis from Edgewood Travel. Things are opening up and it's time to go away. Small businesses fuel the economy, and our travel agency in Walpole is ready. Call us now more than ever and forget the internet. Call us at 508-668-2636. Again, 508-668-2636. Edgewood Travel, we make travel easy, and we've got your back. Bon voyage! Demoulas Supermarkets, under the trade name Market Basket, is a chain of 80 supermarkets in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Maine. Demoulas Supermarkets, Market Basket, more for your dollar.
Welcome to our neighborhood. Our family has been doing business here since 1914. That's our tradition, and that's why we call ourselves Old Neighborhood Foods, bringing you the finest deli meats for over 100 years. All crafted from our family recipes with the finest ingredients, with no MSG, gluten, or trans fats. That's the old-fashioned way. Old Neighborhood, a family legacy of quality and taste.
Old Neighborhood quality meats and cold cuts, available in the deli cases of all Demoulas Market Baskets and wholesale for restaurants, pizza shops, and delis, through Costa's Provisions. Old Neighborhood, Balia Hitonia, a family business owned and operated by the DeMarcus family since 1914.
All right, we're back with the historians. For information on the historians, you can visit us at our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us at TheRealHistorians@gmail.com. Although we may not be answering our emails very much over the next couple of months because we'll be taking our summer hiatus.
Our famed summer hiatus, right, when we go do historical things, researching, exactly, writing, teaching abroad in an extremely pleasant Mediterranean climate, visiting in an extremely pleasant Mediterranean climate of great historical and cultural significance. We do those things because we're scholars, and that's what scholars do in the summertime. So we're up on our scholarly break. As all of you know, we always come to this every year. We take a break, sometimes for a month, sometimes for 2 months, depending on what's going on and where we are. But before we leave, we will have one more rendition of our continuing feature, This Week in Historical News.
This Week in Historical News. And do not worry, listener, we will come back to pick up the story of Greece in the fall. You will hear more.
There will be more.
It's a 2,500-year anniversary of the end of the Persian Wars, and we will be marking that on the historians this fall.
By inviting the warring parties. We want to begin with obituaries. Joseph Almodóvar, last living known member of the international brigades that fought in the Spanish Civil War, has died. So the Spanish Civil War is effectively passing out of living memory as a lived experience, at least for participants. Children would remember it, you know, but they would be people in their 90s. It's passing out of living memory. He was of actually Spanish origins, but was family was living in France, and he joined as a young boy. He fought in Spain, and he was, like many of them, a person of the left. The international brigades are much romanticized by the American left, so to speak, the old American left, much romanticized them. But I do think it's worth noting the passing of this person because, in other words, lived combat experience has now passed out of living memory of the Spanish Civil War. Paulo Mendez de Rocha has died. For those of you who don't know who he was one of the modernist architects who defined Brazil in the 1960s, Brazilian architecture, which becomes enormously influential, just as there's a Brazilian jazz scene and just as there's, it all bespeaks Brazil's engagement with modernism. And
Brazil was a happening place in the 60s.
Yeah, it was a very happening place. He was one of the last great designers of these sort of ultra-modern modernists. He leaned towards brutalism and was really a kind of, he did, as many of them did, He leaned sort of towards brutalism, sharp angles, a lot of concrete. And but his passing, because particularly architecture in Brasilia, the capital, the interior capital of Brazil, and in Rio, really does mark a period of Brazilian architecture that sort of should not be ignored. It's a very, very important moment in modernist architecture. Eric Carle has died, the author of The Very Hungry Caterpillar. Those of you who have children know that the caterpillar has remained hungry for many years. I also read his other classic to my son, Brown Bear, What Do You See? And Do You Want to Be My Friend?
I think I know Do You Want to Be My Friend.
Yeah, Do You Want to Be My Friend? Gavin McLeod, I guess that's how you
Gavin McLeod from Love Boat and the Mary Tyler Moore Show?
Has passed away at age 90.
The Mary Tyler Moore Show is one of the great shows of all time.
He was hysterical. Wow.
He was hilarious.
As was the only two survivors of the leading cast, Ed Asner and Betty White, who I think has got to be 100 years old, Betty White. She was old, older woman at that time.
Yeah.
As Suzanne the Homemaker, she was absolutely hilarious. Yeah. But the thing about Gavin McLeod is that he had that successful series, then The Love Boat, where he was the captain, defining the 1970s, really does define the 1970s. Yeah. And really fabulous, interesting figure in that regard, cultural figure.
Wow.
Finally, in regard to obituaries, a man named Yuan Long Ping has died, which I knew quite a bit about him, but most people probably in our audience have not heard of him. He was a developer of hybrid strains of rice in China at the time of the Cultural Revolution and saved the lives of tens of millions of people by improving rice yields in China. If you ask Chinese people from that period, many people in East Asia will know his name and his ability to do that. He never joined the party, but he was in, they accepted him. But I guess you could see like, hey, your policies are going to kill millions of people here. Why don't we, see if we can do something to change that and develop these hybrid strains of rice, which became, some of them are salt resistant. Some of them are, different types of rice and saved the lives of tens of millions of people. Without a doubt, in my opinion, Yuan Long Ping. And I think some of our people of Chinese heritage, from China will recognize him. We'll recognize that. I want to draw people's attention to a piece from the Boston Globe, which I'm really starting to dislike you, Boston Globe, which isn't good if you're you, from May 26th, about the restoration of the statue of the 54th Regiment Memorial up on Beacon Hill, which, of course, is a memorial to an all-African-American regiment that fought in the Civil War in South Carolina and was heavily trying to capture Fort Wagner, was heavily, shot up.
Yeah.
Took horrendous losses. Their officers were white. They would not allow them to have African-American officers, but the men were African-American. Mm-hmm. The memorial there is being reopened. The piece in the Globe describes, the cleaning, which I think, but it's my understanding, and I may be, and I'm not saying this as a fact, but I ask our listeners to go look. I believe that this memorial was defaced during the rioting in the last year and a half.
I think we reported on that, actually.
And it is absolutely tragic. These people, including their commander, Robert Gould Shaw, gave their life trying to end slavery. They gave these both white and black men, African-American men, gave their lives to end slavery. Why would anyone want to, not respect them? I also say we are as up on the 100-year anniversary of the Tulsa race, racial attacks that led to the burning of large portion of the town, the deaths of several hundred African American people. One of the most horrendous race, conflicts incidents. Or race riots, however we describe that, or massacres in 20th century U.S. history. And of course, many people are marking this, but I did not want to let it go without passing it. It was just horrific. Horrific incident that led to, as I said, hundreds of deaths and the destruction of people's homes and businesses. And it's just a tragic event. There, of course, is far better coverage than we can provide today because of our time constraints. But that there was a terrible massacre. There have been a number of pieces, and this issue keeps arising. And I really encourage people to take a look at it. Is the threat to the dollar's hegemony is the global reserve currency, which has existed since the end of World War II. We're now at 75 years of it. The truth is that it's not under heavy attack yet, but that attack is coming. And I think it's imminent in some form or another. Some people are trying to use cryptocurrencies. I think that's more or less falling apart. But others will find, in other words, other powers want the dollar displaced. They realize how much power that gives the United States. And
well,
how much
I said before, the chief force trying to undermine the dollar is the United States government.
By the printing of money.
Yeah.
And it's clear that no one is, they may be discussing it, but they're not discussing it with the American people, that there's a danger to our long-term prosperity if we just keep printing money that goes beyond inflation, that if people lose confidence in what we're doing in our monetary policy, the dollar will lose its role, hegemony in global trade, and this will impact how much it costs for us to borrow money. All kinds of different issues are tied up with that.
Yep.
There are a number of things going on in Eastern Africa, in the Horn of Africa. And I think that the major pieces that I'm reading, two things are going on, is that a number of powers are working together out of fear of what's going on the, I believe it's the Blue Nile in Ethiopia over the damming of the Nile. Mm-hmm. That has caused a diplomatic crisis. The diplomats of East Africa are burning it up, basically going from one country to another, trying to, you know, work this out. I also think that now questions are being raised about how long can the Ethiopian economy, which, as I've talked about in earlier episodes, is a driver of the economy of Africa. It's the second biggest economy in Africa, given the ongoing fighting in Tigray along the northern border with Eritrea. How long can it be before that violence starts to impact on people's willingness to invest in, you know, maybe lead to capital flight, you know, mm-hmm. people from fleeing Ethiopia? It is not. And some people believe that this is, you know, that the Eritreans see this as a way of strengthening their position in the Horn of Africa. And that may be, I don't know. It's a very complex, but also a very important, you know, the importance of East Africa, Ethiopia, these other countries in East Africa. More Americans need to tune into that. It is very important, and it's a demographically explosive area. The population there is growing rapidly, unlike in other parts of the world where it's in decline. So we have to pay more attention and learn more there. The Horn of Africa continues to be a huge issue. This will sound like a broken record thing. East Asian demographics, piece from the...
I knew that was coming.
From Bloomberg, South Korea crosses a population Rubicon and warning to the world. In other words, they're in the death spiral. The South Korean population is dropping faster. They're in a death spiral, as is the population of Japan. One of the things that we discussed this week off the air was, in Japan now there are 8 million empty houses in the countryside, 8.5 million.
Some of them are being sold. House for like $500.
$500. Some of them are beautiful too. I mean, of course, the construction is much lighter in Japan. There are a number of different issues. China has now gone to every couple can have three children, from the one child policy to we want you to have three kids.
The idea that you can actually inspire people to have children by issuing an order like this or
an edict. Right.
Hilarious. So.
It just isn't there. But we're just going to take a few minutes. It's been a long year. I think everyone has suffered a lot because of the epidemic. And I don't say that sort of melodramatically, but I think people have really, you know, being closed in, people being ill, people dying, people being on their own and starting to lose it, starting to freak out a little bit. There's no, they have. Is that true or not true? It's been horrible. I mean, people got crazy. I think that those things, we really do want to not go off the air for this academic year without noting that and realizing that, hey, better things are ahead. We've got to just, you know, stay positive, work at the things we do. We have tons of problems in our society, tons of problems in American Academy, tons of problems out there. And the best thing we can do is confront them rationally.
One of the things about history that makes it so wonderful is that you can always look back and find out somebody had it worse.
Yeah. Like the Greeks and the other powers in the Eastern Mediterranean during the Dark Period. Yep. They had it far worse. So that's what history tells us. It gives us the comfort of that. And it gives us the comfort of resilience, the value of resilience, and the value of understanding what we believe in and restating it in a way that's appropriate to our time. That is crucially important. People keep saying, what's the value of history? I think that's part of the value of history. It's not a number value. It's a value about what makes us a culture or a society. That said, though, with 1 minute to go, I do want to call your attention to a piece about a new book by a woman named Ruth Skuhr, who teaches at Cambridge, on Napoleon, the horticultural strategist, and about Napoleon's garden obsessions on Elba and St.
Wow.
Helens.
I did not know you were going to bring this up today.
I know, but I usually go to Robin Lane Fox, and I did want to, so I sort of wanted, was going to read a passage from his new book, but then I thought, well, okay, that'll be too decontextualized because we always like to talk about gardening, but Napoleon wanted to establish French garden hegemony across Europe and the world, and the British resistance preserved the strength of the British garden as the model for the world. On that life-affirming note, we will be back soon from our hiatus. We are thinking of you all. We're the historians. ¶¶